I used to transcribe recordings of interview sessions by hand. Let's start there. Like, before I even got to code my transcript, I had to make it.
Right.
So, you know, I think the point Moravi was making about, like, it doesn't get you all the way there, but it gets you close. I think about how many efficiency gains there are, even in imperfect maps of the world being created, that then I can massage, yeah. Right?
Welcome back for this week's episode of Unsolicited Feedback with me, your host, Fareed Mosabat. This week, I'm joined with a new co-host, Ravi Mehta, who has joined us as a guest in the past. Brian will be back in a few weeks, and we have a couple of different co-hosts helping us throughout the next couple of episodes. This week, Ravi and I are in conversation with Behzad Surjani. Behzad Surjani is the lead for a studio called Another Studio, where he helps startups with their customer research problems and has previously worked at companies like Facebook and Slack running their research operations. In part one of our episode, we talk about customer research trends and the impacts of AI on research tools and what that means for product leaders. I hope you enjoy the episode. We'll dive right in.
I have a bunch of notebooks that I've been hopping around, and I open them and I have notes from like 2014 Facebook that I just didn't finish this notebook. And so I keep writing, and then I'm like, oh, like that part of Ads Manager or like the delivery auction. It's like, oh, little yeah. Nostalgia history trip, and then whatever I need to do for the day. It's great.
Behzad, I think that's a good jumping off point. You spend a bunch of time at Facebook. We work together at Slack, and I think we'll get into that in a second. But it would be great to just hear a little bit about what you are up to today. And Ravi here is going to co-host with me, which is exciting. But yeah, what are you up to these days, Behzad?
Yeah, I am doing a bunch of different things. I sort of joke that I'm kind of like Behzad as a service. But I think the palatable way to talk about it is I'm a research consultant and advisor. And a lot of my work is around helping companies make better decisions, very often around thinking about how they use research and do better research, data science, that kind of stuff. I like to say that I sort of function like a personal trainer, where the companies I work with already go to the gym. They are exercising, but they don't feel like they're getting the most out of that time. And a lot of my work is oriented around helping them improve and become more competent and confident in that work so that they get more out of whatever it is that they're doing.
Got it. Cool. When are you finding your like best working with folks? It seems like if you're too early, it's kind of hard to use this muscle well, which is part of why they need someone like you, because they maybe don't have it developed yet.
There's probably three different motions at kind of three different phases of company life cycles. There's some companies I work with that are typically sub 100 people, where there's product managers or even just the founder who's doing research. And very often I'm working with them on how to do that work better. It's, hey, we're trying to make this decision, or will building this feature drive retention? How do I talk to customers? Who should I talk to? That kind of stuff. And so that's often a kind of coaching, direct partnership relationship, helping them do the thing. When folks either are curious about hiring a researcher or are starting to build out a team, there's often a different motion, which is, how do we think about where this fits into the organization? How do we make sure we're not distributing all of the responsibility of understanding customers to this one individual and taking what was probably like a part-time job for 10 people and just like giving it to one person? And so I've helped companies like Replit think about how they hire and what that person would do versus what stays with product and design. And then in a much later stage, I've had the chance to work with organizations like Figma on, hey, we have a research team. We have a lot of different inputs, whether it's customer success, sales, product, et cetera, that are out talking to customers. How do we be more thoughtful about gathering, metabolizing, making sense of all of that, and like actually building better learning practices across the company? It's interesting because I get to play at different points in the life cycle, and I think that's helped me understand what works better at certain stages than others. There's no real like clear recipe. It's very much getting in there, figuring out how they're building products, and then what are some of the small tweaks that will add up to better product development?
One thing that's been really interesting to me in the research realm is, let's say just like 5, 7, maybe 10 years ago, you had like exhaust from your product. What we would traditionally say is the data science team's responsibility, right? Like, hey, how are people using this? How many people are adopting this feature? What's my retention, et cetera, et cetera. But a lot of the qualitative research or what we would call user research instead of data science was more like pull. You had to go out and get it. If that makes sense, you had to run a survey or go talk to customers, et cetera. Or you had to go to your salespeople and be like, what are people saying? You had to drag it out. But with tools like Grain and Gong and all these like AI Zoom things, and also just remote work, making it super simple to record conversations and that being the default and being acceptable. All of a sudden, what we would normally call qualitative data is becoming a giant exhaust. So it seems like there's a struggle here, which is like, one, wow, there's so much more of it. That's awesome. But also, how do I even get through it? How do I make sense of it? Seems like a bigger problem, because you and I work together at Slack, and even something as simple as we have a survey, we have some customer research we've done, we've got a support team, and we've got a customer success and sales team. And we'd like to unify our thoughts on what our customers are saying about our product into a single thing that's well prioritized. It was an impossibly hard problem. And now it's like, I have 40 million recordings of sales calls, all of which are indexable and searchable. And so I'm curious from your perspective, how this has changed research, or where has it made it harder? Where has it made it easier? Because I feel like I'm struggling with it, where someone's like, oh, you can go into Gong and just like search for that term. And I'm like, what? Like, what term do I search for? How do I get there? You know?
If there's been good practices in place, all of the things that have changed have made that better. But the way that I like to talk about it is, our job kind of went from being data gatherers to now being data gardeners.
Okay.
And I think you've seen a really similar thing with data science, right?
Yeah.
Like, data scientists used to be the only ones who could go pull this metric or get this data. So they like went to the well and they like pulled up the data water, and then they were like, okay, I'll make this safe and I'll give this to Fareed and Fareed can drink now. And then we got tools like Tableau and Grafana and Looker and all this. And then like data was just flowing through the pipes. And the job was, how do I make it safe so that anyone who turns on the tap like gets the right metrics out? They have the right dashboards and pipelines and other things, so they're coming to the right conclusions. And I think we're about to see that shift for qualitative research, where, you know, similar to prompt engineering, I think a lot of our responsibility becomes, how do we help our teams and our partners look at qualitative data effectively? So that instead of going into Gong and just searching for a term and then pulling some quote from
random
4 years ago. Yeah, like the product looks so different now than it does when that quote came, but someone's like, hey, I got this video of a customer saying, I think you're like, you do, but that's not at all relevant to the thing that we're trying to solve right now, or it may be from a customer segment that doesn't matter. And I think the shift we haven't seen enough companies make, or enough, I think, researchers make, is, how do I help my product partners more effectively consume and metabolize and synthesize the stuff that exists? And how do I build better guardrails or practices around looking at and kind of playing with data so that they can come to the right conclusion? Because we are past a world where I am going to touch all the data, or I am going to write all the reports. And like, I don't think we ever really wanted to live in that world. But now the risk is, there's so much data that everyone comes to the wrong conclusion. And so I think our job becomes, how do we help people play with data safely and understand what to look for, how to look at that, how to arrive at those conclusions, so that I can then spend my primary research time on things that are high risk, very difficult, require trained hands. And you can go look at the customer support tickets, the sales calls, et cetera, and use that to build intuition and make the decisions that you need.
I think this is also an area where LLMs are going to have a pretty profound impact. Right now, a lot of people are looking at LLMs primarily in terms of enabling chat-based interfaces, but LLMs allow us to interpret and code and analyze qualitative data much more effectively at scale than before. I've been working on a prototype of a system to do this for survey data. And what's interesting is the combination of LLMs plus other forms of AI allow you to label the data
totally
at scale, to cluster it into interesting topics so that you can get emergent topics of what people are talking about within the data. And then you can even feed that data into an LLM again and have it do an analysis. So you can have all the way from, I have 20,000 rows of qualitative data, I don't know anything about what's in there, to AI actually generating reports that are pretty insightful and pretty in-depth in terms of what are the major things that people are talking about. What's the frequency of those things relative to key numeric indicators like NPS or, you know, other things that are important for the business to understand? I think this is the first time where you can actually bridge qual data and analyze it in more of a quantitative way because of the power of LLMs.
In the same way that we've built kind of our own mental models and rules for quantitative data or for analytics, we can have, let's say we're working on some part of Slack, and you as the product manager are like, if customers of this ACV or size mention these kinds of words, I want to know immediately. Else, everything else sits in a reservoir that we can pull from after we've you know, dealt with the stuff that's on the backlog or the roadmap. And so you can then basically do exactly what Robbie's saying, which is like code the stuff that's coming in from customer support or sales calls, tag it, triage it, and then all the things that become urgent for you to deal with, you can immediately integrate into your sprint and handle and whatnot. And like that would have taken multiple, if not dozens of people to do before, coordinated across customer success, customer support, like all these things. And now you can basically put the right pipes in order, put together the right filters and tagging systems, and then you just have all these different reservoirs of feedback to pull from what makes sense. I think people are not excited enough about this, but I'm obviously biased because I live in that world.
I think there's a pretty good analogy here that I've been thinking about a lot around open-ended textual data exhaust from products, right? And then looking at the data stack, the modern data stack that we built over the course of the last decade or so for event data, basically, or quantitative data, I think there are a lot of analogies. So question one is, what is the Snowflake equivalent for all of this textual qualitative data? You can think of that as simple as the messages people are sending to your customer service representatives, all of your survey data, but also other things like what comments are they writing in their Figma comments, right? Now, I realize there's privacy issues, et cetera, which is what makes this complicated. But again, there are questions I want to ask. What types of messages get sent in what types of channels on Slack? Really hard question to answer. Do LLMs help with that? Maybe. But what you need is you need the equivalent of a Snowflake. What is the data warehouse for all of the data that looks like text across all of the inputs? How is it structured properly, et cetera? And right now there's no structure to this stuff. And everyone's just like pushing them into LLMs and hoping the right stuff comes out. So I think that's problem one. I think problem two is the piping into it. So the data equivalent would be things like Fivetran or HiTouch or CDPs, basically, which is like, how does all of this stuff from Gong, from sales calls, from Grain, from Zoom recordings, from my comment system, from it get into that thing and get properly structured? And then there's a whole layer of tools built on top of that that also don't exist, right? One you described, Behzad, is triggering. Like, it's relatively simple for me to go into Amplitude, say, whenever this metric goes below this certain level, send me an alert. But it is very hard for me to say, if I get negative customer service requests on pricing, let me know as the PM because I just made a pricing change. I can put a metric on my experiment dashboard that's like number of customer service tickets, but I can't put number of negative ones, right? Or things like that, right? Or I love the example you had, Robbie. This is like reporting is another layer that needs to exist. What are the most important topics? But actually, hey, I don't want to hear about performance. Performance is like always an issue. We're working on it. I want to know when performance goes from medium to high or when a new thing appears. Like, this was always the problem at Slack, was getting through it and saying, hey, what's a new problem versus what's an evergreen problem? And did the evergreen problem get worse or better? Those are hard questions. So as I think about it, I want to look at the like modern data stack and ask myself, what are all the pieces of it that now that the core data is not user ID X did thing Y, but instead user ID X said thing Y, how does that turn into a modern textual, I don't want to call it qualitative because it's very quantitative, modern textual stack. So if anybody listening to this is building stuff in this world, I want to hear about it. At minimum, just to learn, because I think there's some really interesting stuff. And I'm not sure just dump it all into a RAG pipeline and ask custom LLM text prompts of it and give me summarized responses is the answer. There's got to be so much more than that. Like, what LLMs do is it allows you to pretend unstructured stuff is structured and be able to restructure it. Sorry, that was a very long rant, but I've been thinking about this a lot recently, and I like don't have any answers.
No, it's funny because Ravi and I were having a flavor of this conversation very recently, so okay. I'll make one comment, and then actually I want to hear his take on it. But I don't know if you remember this, Fareed, but I think you and I were standing in the kitchen on 7 in 500 Howard.
We had a lot of conversations.
We had a lot of kitchen conversations. It was a good one. But we were talking about how, I forget who, someone had posted this tweet, I think, and it was like, I don't know how people built products before experimentation.
Yeah.
And we were talking about how you could, you know, arguably run an experiment to come up with any conclusion. And the danger in a lot of these tools is they're power tools that when you point them in the wrong way, they do much more harm than good. And I think the thing that's interesting, and I think we'll get into this later, is the difference between someone doing what you just described really well and someone doing it really poorly doesn't look different from the stack. It yeah. looks different based on what are the kinds of data sources that you're paying attention to, how do you effectively categorize them, what are the questions that you are asking, and what are ultimately the decisions that you care about. Because what are my customers frustrated with is going to take you in some la-la land that like may or may not be helpful versus I own this part of a product and I'm trying to understand what are a certain category of customers struggling with related to performance impacts. Like you can do that and it's a superpower, right? And you're like, don't need to worry about that. Don't need to worry about that. Don't you? Cool. I can keep building the roadmap versus the like, I'm just going to go spelunking in open-ended textual feedback. Like I'm never going to see you again.
It's the same as just like spelunking in SQL data all day long, right?
Totally.
Ravi, it sounds like you've thought about this a lot and are actually tinkering and playing with it. I'm curious what resonates, what doesn't, how long you think this will take for people to figure out.
I think we're pretty close. I think actually from a technology standpoint, we're already there. It's a matter of figuring out how to surface it from a product standpoint. And where I've been getting to so far is with quantitative data, there's a set of filters and transforms and aggregations that we can do because it's just plain math. You can, you know, look at the sum of something. You can look at the average of something. You can filter by something. But for open-ended data, we haven't been able to do that in the past because the data has not been transparent in terms of being able to pull information out of it. And I think that there's going to be a tool or a set of tools that create transforms that are more for qualitative data than they are for quantitative data. So that could be creating a vector embedding so that that data is semantically searchable. It could be running a topic model so that you assign a topic to that piece of data, not just based on that piece of data, but by looking at all of the qualitative data that's available and by clustering it into related groups based on vector similarity. I think there's an extraction transform where you can look at a piece of open-ended data and pull out an email address or pull out a mention of a particular feature. There are summarization, I think, transforms. I think there's sentiment-based transforms, figuring out whether or not something is positive or negative. There's probably other ones as well. Yep. These are the first few that I've been thinking through and kind of been building out some tools to help with. But if you put together the set of things that are now possible with LLMs at sort of a more granular level than just sending a query or a prompt to an LLM and getting an answer back, there's a pretty phenomenal set of very accessible things that you can get out of open-ended data. And I think the next step is for tooling to exist that allows people to treat qualitative data in the same way that they treated quantitative data. So there's some essentially SQL query language, but it's more language focused that will allow people to take a pool of this data and access it in a way that they couldn't before, where, you know, if they did that spelunking, they would never come out. Now they could say, here's a set of things that I'm interested in looking at. This will take time to run. These are not things that run really, really quickly, but then you can get back a report of all the different facets of this data which weren't accessible.
I think the reporting thing is interesting, but where I like what will be even better is once there is this transform layer, right? So we're creating structure out of this unstructured text.
Yeah.
Here's an example of something I can't do and actually don't even really know how to do well, but would love to do in the future. So I'm helping out this community product right now. This is not something we're actually working on, but let's imagine a situation where you're Twitter or another community type product, and you want certain kinds of content to be encouraged in your platform because you're trying to bootstrap a certain community vibe. So I want positive stuff, not negative stuff or whatever. Imagine a world where you could try different posting UX and actually ask the question, what percentage of posts were long form? Okay, that's relatively simple over a certain length versus short, but like, encouraging, positive, supportive, educational. You could start to run an A/B test that's like, we want to see if we can improve the amount of educational content posted in the Reforge community based on this experiment and actually get a statistically significant quantitative outcome if you have enough people to do that. For social networks, this is both dangerous. You can both know enough to manipulate people's behavior, but you've already been able to do that. And I actually think it will be better because instead of just tracking against how much money do I make or how addicted is a person to this, you could actually experiment on vibes. I know that sounds ridiculous, but that's sort of where I think you could go into, and you could actually just answer much deeper questions about products once these transforms and like tools exist, which I think is kind of cool. The other one is we talk about in the product strategy program, how you really want to understand both who your target audience is, what the adoption, the retention, and satisfaction of any individual feature is. Satisfaction is always impossible to get at. My hope would be that over time, as it becomes easier to parse and make sense of this open-ended input, I could actually say the Riverside screen share feature has satisfaction Y based on how many times they said fuck while they were screen sharing, you know, or whatever, or in Zoom, you know, like things like that.
That's probably a really good place to think about where LLMs make things really different. Because in the old world, you have some analyst who's probably doing a search based on transcripts for just the presence of word with maybe a co-occurrence, right? But an LLM can just be like, okay, we know that this word exists in various sets of categories, go, right? And you end up with much richer data coming back. And I think that the benefit of this world that we live in is the LLMs hopefully are making you smarter, right? Because as you say, like, what is a set of words or phrases that co-occurs with these key terms? You then have a much better lens to look at things. I think about for Slack, you know, we used to, on the tracking survey, we would look at words like communication or meeting or stuff like that, because one of the measures was like, how does Slack change the way that your team communicates? And so I would run an R script that was like, literally like find open ends with, you know, stems like calm, meet, email, whatever. And that would basically be me, Nicole Zhang, other folks on the research team who'd thought enough about how might people talk about communication. Now we're in a world where I'm like, show me communication posts, or what are people saying about communication? And I can sort of trust the model, or, you know, work with prompt the model to get to a better place of like, hey, communication actually gets talked about in this six ways that you're familiar with, and all of this other stuff that you have no idea about. And I think that opens up a lot more space for us in our understanding of what customers are talking about, how they're using the products. But again, ends up in this fine line of you could totally go left and just disappear into I'm going to be playing with data all the time.
And I think the thing that was rate limiting before was you had to have a labeled data set. So if you knew exactly what you wanted to look for, you wanted to look for sentiment or you wanted to look for profanity, you could create a large data set. You could go through the expense of labeling that data set and build a dedicated model and then deploy that model. And that's just a long and unwieldy process. And now to do the type of thing, Reed, you're talking about where you want to dynamically look for vibes, I think what's really interesting now is that you can have with LLMs self-supervision. So the LLMs can actually figure out the vibes as long as you give it some context. And as a result, it can create its own labeled data set and won't be perfect. It'll have more errors than a human coded data set, but that gives you a start on being able to very rapidly create new models to test different things so that you can run that experimentation.
I mean, what percentage of your time, Behzad, as a relatively junior researcher, was spent manually coding text responses? Like, what a huge pain in the ass. Right?
I used to transcribe recordings of interview sessions by hand. Let's start there. Like, before I even got to code my transcript, I had to make it.
Right.
So, you know, I think the point Moravi was making about, like, you know, it doesn't get you all the way there, but it gets you close. I think about how many efficiency gains there are, even in imperfect maps of the world being created, that then I can massage, right? Like the tools like Grain, Otter, et cetera, where here's a transcript of the conversation. When I started my career, that would have been a dream. And I think especially for research, there's far less chance for hallucination because it's like, oh, Ravi said this. And I'm like, tell me where in the conversation that happened. And it's like, boop, here is the data source. The energy gets spent so much more on the synthesis, not on the
right
gathering, cleaning, transcribing, getting the prep work to do any of the things that I want to do.
And I think the interesting thing here is, look, we look at a lot of this stuff as, oh, I used to do X and now X takes 10% of the amount of time. But there's a different thing, which is that when you close the loop between idea and knowledge, if that makes sense, like I think about this a lot in data. Yeah. If I have to go to an analyst to ask a question, to get a response, I'm going to immediately ask, is this worth that analyst's time? And the answer is usually no. So we don't do it and we don't gain that knowledge. Now, if it's just me sitting at 6 p.m. at my desk because I got to wait for the bus and I have an idea and I'm good enough at SQL, let's just say in a regular quantitative thing, to start goofing around, I might discover something because that loop is closed. It's a closed loop between idea and execution, and I can iterate quickly and I can get to something that now all of a sudden I'm like, ooh, I don't know if this is right because I'm not a great data analyst, but it's good enough to actually hand off and be worth that person's time to do the real work of getting it. Quantitative data has traditionally been like, I would love to know if people hate our new pricing. And you're like, well, okay, so I got to run a survey. I got to talk to this many people. I got to recruit. I got to pay them. I got to give them Amazon gift cards. I got to do this, 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 and this. Is it still worth it? It's going to take a month. No, a month is too long. I won't do it. So by closing the loop, A, so that a non-researcher can ask these questions and answer, but also iterate quickly because of the labeling, because of the, you know, oh, I decided to imagine if I told Azad, hey, you coded this all wrong. The thing I actually want is this other dimension. Go look at every single transcript and do it again. He would be like, forget it, buddy. You're the worst, right? But I can ask that of a robot. So anyway, I think it unlocks new use cases. And I think what happens when you like speed up the learning loop is you just get better faster. And it's going to be really interesting to see how that plays out, because most companies don't even have research teams until they're like very large, because it's just a huge pain in the butt to do. But now you have designers doing user research, PMs doing it, salespeople doing it, because the tools are there. And that's unlocked the exhaust, but analyzing the exhaust is still hard.
One of the big pieces of advice I give to a lot of the companies I work with at early stages is when you hire a researcher, I actually don't think they should do any primary research for the first 3 months, because there's so much of this infrastructure and reorientation and kind of cleanup work that needs to happen in the company of like, what data is coming in and how is it being treated? And how do you start to build better practices around ingesting and making sense of that data, and then go and start gathering your own stuff? But I think that the challenge that comes with this deluge of all of these fire hoses that people have access to now is it's so much easier to get misled if you aren't paying attention, if you're not looking at the right things in the right ways. And I think that aspect of textual or qualitative data literacy has to change for a lot of people who build products, because so often we've over-indexed on the breadcrumbs that we had and the table scraps, because to your point, like going and doing the research was probably expensive. And so the bar for, is this not only feasible, but is this reasonable and worthwhile, was really high.
There's also a bias issue. I think when people go into qualitative data and they read it and they manually code it, or they try to draw insights from it, they typically come out with insights that are aligned with what their opinions were going in, because there's no quantitative basis for it. You're not actually counting the number of occurrences of particular mentions or particular topics. And so that's another area where I think LLMs can help get to deeper, richer data that can actually be used as evidence versus has some of these biases associated with them.
I would love for folks who are starting to implement this stuff, you know, if you think about your PRDs or other things like that, and if this becomes an input kind of source to some of these decisions, show me customer feedback that makes me think I shouldn't do this. What is the bear case for the things that are happening? Or what could go wrong based on past launches? What could go wrong based on current sentiment from this customer set, right? And like, how do we prepare or sort of preload the like negative and then try to counterbalance like, oh, we think this is going to be great. Well, like, why might this not work? Why might people hate this? What could go wrong? And I think that also just gets a lot easier, that we can then start to counteract those things in the way that we do product development or launches or positioning, whatever.
100%. Yeah.
All right. That was super fun to think about, and I hadn't even planned it, but that's the joy of these conversations, is just sort of like finding it. Robbie, I didn't even know that you were working on stuff in this angle. It's just been on my mind for a while. That's super cool. I really love the transformer like mental model. I think that's a really smart one here.
It's been interesting. I've been working with Erica to do an analysis for change.org petitions to figure out what are the things that people say that actually lead to a victorious petition. And I've been doing another one for an e-tailer to figure out what are the things that drive NPS. And once we get the data and we look at what mentions are actually correlated with NPS, there's very different conclusions than, you know, what you get just on the face of it by looking at the data. and spending, you know, an hour or two spelunking.
I love that. Like, that petition one is a really interesting type of use case, like what I was describing in terms of how can I drive certain kinds of community behavior, which is answering the question, where are we growing? That's not a simple demographic answer, right? Like, we're growing in India, we're growing in these, you know, company sizes, but rather what use cases is my horizontal open-ended product growing in are actually pretty hard to do well and maybe are easier now. If you were Otter or Grain, right? And you were asking like, what kinds of calls is our recent growth in user acquisition in 2 years ago would be basically an impossible thing to answer. I've heard similarly that certain social networks, I think it was Nextdoor and others, can actually have some tools to help you make better posts based on this kind of sentiment analysis and stuff. So this is what I mean by the point of Snowflake for qualitative data is not just like in V1 of the data stack. Data was just used internally to help make decisions. But as machine learning, search, et cetera, got better, there was a world in which that data, aggregated data, actually powered the product to be better. And I think we'll see an accelerated version of this for what I'll call the qualitative modern data stack, right? Which is like, first it'll be like, help PMs figure out sentiment. And then it'll be like, help me build dashboards. And then it'll be like, help me make alerts and triggers to be able to drive internal tools and processes. But eventually it will be like, help my customers make better posts in my social network so that they get the response that they are looking for through our combination of qualitative analysis with machine learning type stuff on top of it. So I think we'll just see an accelerated version of this. And that full closed loop is when stuff gets really exciting, right? Like the same way you can have ML models driving great recommendations, you could have LLM-based analysis of your content drive better outcomes for you as a person, you know, or as a product manager or whatever.
I don't know if either of you remember this because it was sort of niche at the time, but there was a big study that Facebook did around 2012 that was called like Emotional Contagion. Mm-hmm. Adam Kramer was the data scientist and Facebook got skewered. The kind of context for this was there was this potential belief that seeing too much positive content in feed was making other people feel sad.
Yeah.
And so Facebook was trying to, from what I understand, I didn't work on the team and was not on core data science. But like my understanding was there was an experiment that Adam and others ran to see if altering the presence of certain emotional textual content in feed changed the valence of people's responses. And when people realized that Facebook was experimenting on them, which to me, again, Facebook runs all sorts of experiments all the time, like many products do. I think that's more normalized now. But the public outcry was intense. And I have to be curious how much different running something like that would look today, because I imagine that you could do it with a lot of these updated models and ML tools, and you probably wouldn't have had to run an experiment. I imagine the work of the labeling and everything else was so expensive and so time-consuming that they had to create a controlled environment where now you could look more organically at what's happening. But it's just wild to think about like how far we've come in a decade and what is now possible that was not only impossible, but like would have been transformative.
We had an interesting example of this at Tinder, where the Tinder trust and safety team was working on models to detect profanity and obscenity. But one of the challenges with Tinder is sometimes things that people want to say on Tinder are on the edge of something that someone else would consider profane or obscene. So we had a set of things where we knew this is definitely something that we wanted to moderate out of the system. And then we had a set of things that were on the bubble where, you know, we weren't sure whether or not this was going to be in the list of things that were profane or something that a person was totally fine with. And so we launched a feature called Does This Bother You? And so if someone got a message that was on the bubble, we would ask, does this message bother you? And if you said yes, we would give you tools to be able to block that person or to report the language. And if you said no, we would feed that back into the system and we would know for that particular person, this type of language doesn't bother them. And so we were able to get reinforcement learning as a result. And then a feature that they launched recently, which is based on this, is a feature called Are You Sure? And so if you compose a message and you hit send and it's on the bubble, we'll ask you, are you sure you want to send this? This might be something that the recipient will find offensive. And so you can, you know, choose to send it or you can decide not to send it. And this is, I think, a really interesting example of where you've got a combination of ML models, plus product UX, all of which enables a better dialogue within the platform.
That feels like such a great example of meaningful friction in a product, where I feel like one of the things that I heard so often in my career was like, early in the career, like, remove all the friction, remove all the friction, remove all the friction. I'm like, we knew this from advertisers spending millions of dollars, or in this case, like sending messages to potential matches. There's plenty of good cases for friction in the product experience that helps you then make better products and, you know, product decisions. I mean, Fareed, I think one of the ones that was common at Slack was like whether we asked role in your onboarding, right? If we knew who you were in a company, we could do so many things to curate your Slack experience. But at various points of time, we were like, we don't want to, you know, take that hit on onboarding or conversion or sign up or whatever. So get rid of the friction. And those are trade-offs that I think every product and team has to dance with. But there's great examples of why those little injections end up being so helpful.
Yeah. Tons of examples of adding friction actually resulting in counterintuitive positive results that I can think of, but I won't get into all of them. But there are enough now that I find the remove steps to improve conversion adage to be basically wrong. There are enough opposite examples for me at this point that I've like literally done, lived through, experimented, not only experimented, but were so shocked by the results that I could not possibly believe they were correct and iterated on for months to try to prove the opposite and turned out not to be the case. One in particular is like asking people for their email address and password on Instacart outperformed any of the no account versions of the flow that we built. I'm sure this has maybe changed today, but at the time it was worse, always worse. And the best hypothesis I have for that is it's worse because it's a hard thing to do to fill a basket for the whole grocery thing. It's a high intent thing. So by escalating and asking for little bits of intent, you basically increase that person's like psychological comfort and also willingness to take the next step. But if you dump them in to a giant grocery site and like every other e-commerce site that's single purchase has shown time and time again, asking for account lowers conversion. But for us, it was the opposite every single time, to the point where I had to make like very detailed graphs, funnels, analysis, et cetera, to prove to everybody because no one believed me. Like no one believed us. It was crazy. So maybe not true on certain other flows, et cetera, like SEO traffic, but for front door traffic, it always outperformed, at least in the time I was there.
What I like about that example, and I think related to some of the stuff we were talking about, is if you understand how to look at the data and what that data actually represents, you can come to these really rich conclusions and insights. People are making these high intent things, and the more we can chip away to get them bought in, like psychologically, the more success we will have, right? But if you don't understand what you're looking at, you have people who are looking at that data and being like, this is dumb and I don't believe it. And then they just dismiss it, right? And I'm very curious to see 5-10 years from now, like what data literacy looks like across product teams, because I feel like it has to get better. Like there's so much stuff. There's so much around that the people who don't know how to use data well will not succeed. And the people who know how to leverage data will.
Yeah. You know. I think there's an interesting litmus test here for friction in a funnel. And the litmus test is, are you asking a user a question that they know the answer to, or are you asking something to them that they may not know the answer to? And so this is an example where the data might suggest one thing. You just want to make the funnel shorter and shorter, but the psychology is very different. And if you ask a person a question that they know the answer to, even if it's like not a meaningful question, it does do exactly what you said, Fareed. It increases their escalation and it sort of propels them down the path. And then every question that they answer that they get right, that they knew the answer to, they're more and more committed to completing the process. I think an interesting example of this is I've been doing some stuff in the healthcare industry and looking at companies like Roe and Hims, and the conversion funnels for many of their products are really long.
Yeah.
The weight loss conversion funnel for Roe is about 40 screens long. They're getting a lot of information about the person during that process, but they're also educating the person during the process, and they're escalating their commitment during the process. So great example of a high-performing funnel that they can run really well in paid search, but is actually very long.
People forget this, but LinkedIn, no one that listens to this podcast has probably signed up for a new LinkedIn account in the past like decade. So I don't even know if this is still true, but I looked into this when I was at Instacart because we were thinking through some flows. We hired a lead. Our new CPO is from LinkedIn. We were digging into it. The LinkedIn sign up at the time was like 25 or 30 steps on Rails, no out, no way to get to LinkedIn, like hardcore fill out your profile. And it was like all profile information and the reason and invites and all the other things. And the reason for that is like there is network value in acquiring this profile, right? That is like 100x more valuable than not filling out the profile. And by the time they've dug in, maybe they're willing to invite, connect, respond, et cetera. I don't know what the theory was, but like we're talking crazy long, total opposite of any conventional wisdom. And I think it's basically, yeah, creating a profile, creating an online resume takes a lot of time and effort. But as you do it, you're more and more committed to finishing. And there's a lot of network value that occurs at the end of it. And you're asked to connect with all the people you know. So there's all these tied up things. So anyway, there's plenty of examples. I think those healthcare ones are really interesting. It also works because it's such high LTV. It's like the better I can get to the right answer and the more I'm a fit for you and the more committed you are, the more value there is on the other side. So yeah, I think there's some really interesting stuff there.
So we did some testing at TripAdvisor during the review submission flow, and we found we could add a nearly unlimited number of questions without decreasing conversion rate, as long as those questions were phrased in a certain way. So if you asked a person, is this hotel handicap accessible? You would get a decrease in conversion rate because a lot of people hit a question they just don't know the answer to. And so then they bounce. They're like, I don't know. They kind of want to know this information. All of a sudden there's cognitive load and they don't want to complete the form. But if you ask them, is this hotel family friendly? And they've said that they were traveling with a family, then they know the answer. They have an opinion on whether or not it's family friendly. Really easy for them to fill out. And then they feel like they provided more value. And it doesn't have any sort of negative impact on conversion. And so really interesting example of how to think about this specifically from a consumer psychology standpoint so that that longer flow adds value to the system and also adds value to the user as they're filling out those questions.
Yeah, super interesting. I have always given the advice to people that are not, especially non-engineers in startups, that if you want to accelerate your career, the number one skill you should learn is learn how to query data with SQL. Because now you are an answerer of questions instead of an asker of questions. And you are a source of insight and you can do it independently, which means you can chase the things that don't look important yet and make them important once you've discovered those answers. And I worry this may not continue to be good advice. One, because it's not writing SQL, it's really like, get answers from data. And two, these other tools like SQL is not the interface that is, I don't think, that you're going to interact with these things. So I'm curious if you were to broaden that advice a little bit, especially you based on interacting in a lot of different orgs around research. And actually, Ravi, it sounds like you're doing that too. If I'm a customer success person who wants to be a product leader, what should I be getting good at right now? Because the just learn SQL, like made, it doesn't feel like the source of real alpha, not to use an investing term, but like the source of a passing lane, the way it used to be, because the really interesting stuff is all this open-ended text data. And it seems like if you want a passing lane, it's figure that out. I don't know.
I think that I would change the advice that I give, but I think the core of what you were pointing people at is you should be data literate in a way that helps you better understand what's happening with the customers, the product, and the business. And I think that that advice is still true, that if you are someone who is building products, you should not only abstracted from data, understand how your product solves a problem and what are some of the key moments in that product journey. Like what is someone doing with your product? But you should also understand how those behaviors are classified, categorized, operationalized, and tracked in data so that when metrics move, you understand what that actually represents in the real world, what may have driven those things, and is that good or bad? At Facebook, when I started my career, one of the things that a lot of people were kind of put through was this like, go understand all the core metrics. And this was because Rob Goldman, who was our VP of analytics at the time, spent the first part of his day looking at dashboards across the products. And if Rob knew that something happened before you did, like Rob was coming to you and being like, hey, I saw that this was up XYZ%. And so all of us were sort of encouraged, become very aware of how our customers use the product and how those behaviors were reflected in metrics so that we could develop an understanding of this is changing in the world, therefore this is probably changing in the product, therefore this is probably changing in how the data looks. And I think that that is true. I think the expression of those literacies is different now, but I think the core idea, I would argue, is still as important, if not more important, because we're going to deal with more bad data, and you need to be able to understand signal and noise to a much more refined and nuanced way than I think you did 10 years ago.
So I think there's probably two things. One is on the front end, really learning to talk to customers, learning consumer psychology, learning the elements of design. I think all three of those things are things that are usually in short supply in organizations,
yeah.
Especially tech companies. There's usually a lot of people that understand how the software works. There's usually people that are pretty data oriented. And the thing that people aren't doing is figuring out how to really understand the customer and then how to present functionality in front of the customer that works well for them. So that's a set of things that I think are really important. In terms of how to think about where data is going and how to get information and insight from it, I think two things are really helpful. One is so many companies are using Amplitude now. It pays to be really, really good at Amplitude. And so most companies are interfacing either through Amplitude or some tool like that rather than SQL. So it's important to get really good at that. And then for PMs that want to get to the next level of data insight and understanding, I think it's really helpful to learn Python. It's not that hard to learn.
Totally.
You can pull in qual data. You can pull in quant data. You can transform it. You can visualize it. You can do rudimentary scraping. You can build little admin tools. You can build scripts for certain things. And as a product manager, I think it makes you just much more powerful because you can start to interface with the product and with the data in a way that you couldn't without those skills.
And that's a wrap on this episode of Unsolicited Feedback with our guest, Behzad Surjani. Thanks for listening.